Welcome to the Reasoning with an Optimist podcast for the week of September 27, 2015. This is Jack Brissett Mills. We have a pretty amazing conversation today with Maria Victoria, a teacher in the best sense of the word, meaning she has never stopped learning. The verses for the week, I wrote this one 2 years ago, verse 26. The dynamic forces over eons of time that turned matter into teeming life, I feel deep within me, a strength that flares up, at once impelling me onward and placing the reins in my hands. And this one, 26a, I wrote last year, both about the same Rudolf Steiner verse from his Calendar of the Soul. Verse 26a. The creative force of all earth life, I feel glowing in my will, urging me to a spiritual path, that my newborn self, now so tender, will thrive on fruitful ground. So Maria Victoria and I had a conversation at her high school. You'll hear kids' voices and maybe air conditioners, and it was really kind of fun to talk so deeply in that crowded place. I don't know if it's going to work as an idea, but it seems like it's something that can grow, that I'm apparently promoting the idea of elevated conversation, that people can converse, and as they converse, they listen, first of all, and not try to respond. They're not trying to think of the right response. They're trying to listen to the other person. And then when they do respond, it's not to put in their own opinion, but to try to help the other person come to what they were trying to say. Mm-hmm. So this is a nice method for a study group or a branch meeting. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you're trying not to just talk about the most commonplace thing. You're trying to bring it up into a little higher realm. It's, it seems like a kind of a silly thing at first, maybe, and it seems kind of a pain at first. Why can't we just go about our life without this? But I find that the more I do it, and going back to Goethe, that it's worth more than gold. It's if you can have a good conversation with someone, it's actually, it heals the soul.
It's like using the conversation as a way to observe, well, you know, through the senses, right, of what's happening from the person who speak of that.
Yes,
know?
Yes.
What if you're listening with imagination and intuition and, you know, inspiration and intuition?
Yes.
And then your response can be part of a whole instead of something.
And a pair of people can build something then, instead of question answer or repartee. Which is very appropriate, I suppose, for the workplace. Many times you're not trying to be helpful to your colleagues. You're actually fighting all the time.
So true. It's really appropriate.
Yeah.
I think the more we would benefit a lot from doing that.
Yeah, I've got some good comments for spouse-on-spouse kind of conversation, but even with people that you do have a definite problem with, if you actually conversed as though you were interested in what they were saying, they would change how they feel about you. Maybe not immediately. But then the subject is, it just can come then, or I had a couple of people who had a definite thing they wanted to talk about. You're so talented in so many things. I'm tempted to almost ask you
what you've been thinking, you know, what cool thing. It doesn't have to be the new thing. Mm-hmm. I get a little tired of that what's new kind of question.
Hmm.
But have you had in the last year a thought that you felt, this is an important thought I had? Because I think you and I have these things that come and go, and then maybe they become so common that we don't even notice them, but they're actually important to our life.
Yeah.
Almost like a thesis.
Mm-hmm.
If these thoughts keep recurring to you, and you go, that's really something for me, that thought. And it becomes so normal that you don't even notice it. But someone like me hearing your thought, your thesis of your life, would be very interesting. I don't know if you've even thought of such a thing.
Yeah.
But
well, I do have a thought that keeps recurring, and it's funny, it's recurring now.
Okay.
So as I was speaking a moment ago and said, it reminds me of, you know, the Gertian observation method.
Yes, yes.
Of, you know, moving into the different stages of observation and coming out in a full relationship with the event or the conversation or the thought or, you know, whatever it is. It's funny because this past summer, so this is something, you know, that I learned the Gertian observation method many, many years ago through a biological process where we did the exercise.
Could you describe anything about that? Because people might have never heard that term before.
Okay. So, without going into too much detail, the basic process is, and I'll use the plant as an example. If you take something, and it could be a plant, it could be anything, and you just begin to observe the physical parts of the plant, and you start to look at the plant, and you describe the plant, and you see the shape and the color and the size. And
are you avoiding any natural human instinct? I mean, it seems like that's common and obvious, but actually, isn't it that we generally try to add something to what we're looking at?
Right. So in this exercise, you try to just focus on the physical and not adding anything else, any judgment, any other, you know, just purely the physical aspects of the plant. And so that's the step one of observation. And then in the second step of observation, you can allow yourself to use imagination. And in that part, you're looking at more of some of those things that you might have thought, you know, in the first step if you hadn't stopped yourself, but things that are not visible, but that you know are there and that might have to do with, you know, the inner processes of the plant. For example, if you knew about photosynthesis, you might be able to say, oh, you know, this plant is undergoing a process of some sort. Yeah. Or you might be able to observe something at the level of how the plant is being what it's being. And
may I interrupt you and ask, are you also able at that point to change the view of time? So you're looking at a living plant, but could you also imagine the seed later in the year? Is that a good part?
No, at that point, you don't go so far yet.
Okay.
That's actually the next step.
All right.
So you limit it a little bit just to the imagination of how the plant is presently, but then in the next step, then you begin to use more of what we call inspiration.
Right.
And Goethe describes it exactly as you say, where you can really start to imagine the plant, you know, you can observe the plant being all of those things that it might have been before it came to the state that it's in now, and also where it might be going. And there may be sections of the plant that have a flower and sections of a plant that are just sprouting at the root, or sections of the plant that are in all of the different stages of that arch, you know, from seed to fruit back to seed. And then you can really have an inspiration of a complete cycle of what the plant experiences.
So you've left the present moment then. The first two stages were the present moment, I think. Yeah. And now you've left the present moment.
You've left the present moment, and you're only looking at little winks of time that may be evident at some level in the plant in different ways. Or may not, you know. It might be a plant that's dying in the fall, but there might be some little evidence of something. It depends on the plant, of course, that you're looking at and all of those things. And then in the last stage, you take all of those observations and you look at the... You know, it's an intuitive exercise in looking at what is my relationship to the plant. For example, of course, you know, I breathe oxygen, the plant needs carbon dioxide, we have this exchange. That's one obvious relationship that we have with the plant. But it can also be a place where we as human beings start to see the plant as a being of itself and something that is in and of itself, just as I am in and of myself, what I am. And to really come to a place where the connection between the plant and all that it is to the rest of the world is similar to the connection that I have to the rest of the world. And so the process of observation becomes more and more participatory as you go along.
Definitely.
And
this process you described could be either in 1 hour or half an hour at least,
mm-hmm.
or over many, many days or many, many years,
mm-hmm.
of getting better at each stage.
Yes. And, you know, one thing that I've been thinking a lot about, there's two sort of side threads that have led me back to this over and over again. And one of them is in my work, because we, in the Waldorf pedagogy, we talk about in the 9th grade, and these are just very simple guides that we use, but in the 9th grade, we ask the question, what, a lot. What is it? What does it do? What size is it? What color is it?
Nice.
What?
Very physical observation.
Yes,
right?
Very physical observation. And in 10th grade, the big question is how? You know, how does it work? How did it become this way? How did it die? How was it born? How? You know, these ideas of just the beginnings of it's a little place of opening to the next step, which is the why. And if you see what I'm saying, we actually are going step by step from physical to, you know, physical observation to imaginative observation to inspired observation.
Nice.
And then continuing on to in 12th grade, the question is it's a synthesis question. And who is the big question? Who? Because it's the intuition. Is it me? Is it the plant? Is it we? Who? And so one of the things that I've been able to really understand in the last few years is that in my work, I'm working with the process of helping other young people to develop these skills of observation. And you do it in math, you do it in history, you do it in science, you do it in every way. And in the end, if they can be master observers of the world and of themselves, they have hopefully a huge, we've planted a seed there, you know, for huge potential in any area.
You brought this all up. The whole Goethe idea came up when I asked you about an important thought you had over the last year, a thesis of your life. Tell me now what that means to you. I mean, why you brought that up.
Well, I brought that up because I see it as the more I start to find places in my life where, oh, here's another place that this type of observation can be used. For example, in the way that you spoke about listening, to me, that's another example where I can use Goethean observation in my listening.
Very nice.
And there are many times where things come up and the question comes to me, oh, here's another way that I can use Goethean observation. So observation to me has become something that has transformed. It's not visual anymore. It's a sensorial experience. And then, of course, you know, that's another thing, because I've started to wonder, as I've studied other ideas about the 12 senses and about the evolution of consciousness,
yes.
I've started to wonder if, in some ways, in this process of developing our observation beyond just the seeing, but observing with your ears, observing with your heart, observing with different senses, with, you know, and that's another tangent that we could go into.
Yes, yes.
But it's as if the development of the individual can go that route, the same way that you might see humanity actually developing their senses through the evolution of consciousness in some way. And so, sounds a little far out.
No, I like that. I mean, the 12 senses right away, people go, there's 5 senses. But we know for a fact, even without going very far, can you tell if you're healthy or sick? Isn't that a sense?
Right.
There's more than 5 senses.
The sense of life, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so as soon as you open the door, yes, there are more than 5.
Mm-hmm.
Stopping at 12 might be difficult, actually,
mm-hmm.
right? My friend just told me about a technique. If someone is panicked, for example, drowning, it's important that you get their eyes to look in your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And I right away thought of the sense of the ego, the other.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can see that there's an ego looking at you, and that you are an ego yourself, suddenly you're not as panicked as you were when you were in the animal state of life or death.
That's true.
And so the 12 senses is not at all a far-fetched mm-hmm. idea. The fact that we may have senses that are beyond physical, that may be far-fetched. Of course, we all anecdotally have evidence of it.
Mm-hmm.
And some of us practice it.
Mm-hmm.
This idea that I was talking to someone about texting, that we as humans, without being given a cell phone by culture giving us a cell phone, I believe we were at the stage where we knew it was time for us to develop the ability to know where our family is
mm-hmm.
and to be able to communicate with them
mm-hmm.
directly.
Yeah.
But because we were given this device, we go, oh yeah, this is what I was looking for.
Mm.
And we suddenly don't care any longer about developing the ability. If you're in a store with your spouse and you wonder where they are, you don't just think and feel where they are and go over there. You text them
mm-hmm.
and say, where are you? And so we're losing the chance
mm-hmm.
to develop the higher faculty.
Right.
I mean, that's just a theory, but I really feel it as a fact myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true. There's something of our will development that we put to the side when we use tools in the way that we're using them, and I struggle with that a lot, especially being around teenagers all day.
Yep. You know? What could they accomplish without that distraction, or without that giving them what they want, without, you know, if you want light,
mm-hmm.
it's one thing to figure it out. How can I get light in this room?
Mm-hmm.
Another thing just to turn the switch.
Mm-hmm.
You lose so much imagination and creativity mm-hmm. when the solution is given to you directly.
Right. And especially if you're not knowledgeable about how that solution worked to be what it is. And so with technology, oftentimes the method and the mechanism is hidden from us.
Yeah.
And we don't even really understand how it works. You know?
So I never thought of this Gertian observation with listening. That's lovely. So you have been feeling it then for a time that because of your work with plant observation, you're able somehow to open up to different methods of perceiving even your fellow humans in a more fourfold kind of way.
I think so. I think that for me, observation has become something that's not visual, certainly not visual all of the time. And the links that process has to other areas of my work has been, for example, when I discovered, I'm like, oh, ninth grade what, 10th grade how, 11th grade why, I thought, of course, and it made perfect sense, but it took me years to realize that that's actually the core of the curriculum and the relationship that that has to the Gertian observation. And then I realized, if that's what the kids are doing, and they're doing that same process in botany, you know, with for example,
I was going to ask that: is it just the science? Is it just the science? Is it all the sciences, or is it also literature?
I do it with paintings with my students. I do it with maps in my history classes. I do it with. It could even be a historical event. We could begin with, okay, what are the facts? What really just happened? And you can give, some dates and some people's names and some basic activity that everyone agrees happened. And then you move into the imagination and you look at how did this happen? Where did this, occur? And you get deeper and deeper into observing a historical event, but it's the same process. And at some point you realize these are human beings that lived at this time. And, what would I have done? What would that experience have been for me? It could be the fall of Rome. It could be the beginning of agriculture. It could be World War I. It could be a civil rights movement. You can look at any historical event through that process and come out with a really deep human understanding of it. And so I use it over and over again, and the more I use it, the more I'm in love with it.
Yeah, I know. And did you have a feeling that, well, first of all, I don't think anyone ever tells you when you go into Waldorf teaching, by the way, we teach what in ninth grade and how in 10th grade. I don't think people say those words.
Most people don't say those words.
But there's some reality to a child of that age being ready for that method of teaching.
Well, we learn it in teacher training, when we're looking at what is developmentally appropriate.
Yes.
For example, ninth grader, they are just meeting the world and really starting to feel their vulnerability. And so knowing the concrete physical facts is comforting. And having, ninth graders, they can graph, they can chart, they can put things in order, they can do things that are very concrete, and that helps them feel like the world makes sense. It's the gray areas that are uncomfortable and difficult for them. So, because they're still just breaking into the world and not very comfortable with it just yet. They still have one foot in their family life, one foot with their friends, and starting to just begin to develop this individual sense. And so the polarities is what we give them. We give them the black and the white, the good and the bad. These things are really therapeutic for them.
You see that as a result. Someone gives you the idea in teacher training, you try it several years, and you say, this is right.
This is right, yeah. Because if you give them, you know, here's what they don't want. They don't want inconsistency.
Ninth
they don't
graders.
Want hypocrisy.
Yes, yes.
They don't want, they want to know exactly what's going on here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that should not change because,
yeah.
you know, then that would be inconsistent.
Yes.
And I can't handle that.
Yes.
You know, I'm not ready for that. And so talking about gray areas.
May I ask, how does it, for you as an adult, to see this development stage? And using these methods that you mentioned that you and I can use for plant observation, for even spouse observation, right?
Yeah.
We can learn to use these methods for ourselves, even though we are not at that stage. What's the difference there? That why is it appropriate for them at age 16, 17, 18? And then how does it meet us differently? I've often had that question.
Yeah.
Why does it so ring true with them and fit with me too?
Mm-hmm. I think
I mean, that's a life's work, of course, to figure that out. But
yeah.
what have you come with? What have you come up with?
Well, you know, I'm certainly not there yet. I think I have more questions than answers.
Yeah.
And I often tell my students, if you have more questions than answers, then you're on the right
that's
track.
That's great, yeah.
But what I do see is, you know, that physical observation, for example, for the ninth grader, it's definitely that's where they are. And so, you know, there may be some areas in my life where I just need the physical observation because I'm not ready to go any deeper.
Nice.
And there may be other areas in my life where I have a little more experience and feel more comfortable coming into a situation or a topic or an idea. And so for me, it's the method of observation that actually it's not even observation anymore. It's a method of being in relationship with the world. And I'm better at it in some things than I am in others. And but using that process over and over again tends to give me some sense of, you know, there's some kind of archetypal process that perhaps I can apply to just about everything.
Yeah, I wonder if there is something it wouldn't work at. Right away, I jump to meditative practice. And, of course, the first thing you do with meditation is try to see, where am I? You look inward first time, and you go, what is going on? What is
mm-hmm.
going on in here?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that that would work as an inner practice as
mm-hmm.
well as anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I wonder, what wouldn't work with that series of steps?
Mm-hmm.
What wouldn't work?
I think it's true, you know, and how powerful that could be if it was a group of people
tackling a larger issue.
Yeah. Or, you know, I mean, we could use that kind of method for social issues, political issues, who knows what
very
we could
nice.
Come up with.
Very nice.
You know.
And so that's very, very nice. Thank you very much. That's lovely. I will try that.
Let me know. I'll keep practicing myself.
Teachers are so practical, really, if they're good teachers. They're problem solvers, of course, they're problem solvers with humans and with the material, you're encountering material you don't understand as a teacher many times. To figure it out for yourself, that makes you a better teacher because you just figured out how to do it. You just figured out how to figure it out.
I figured it out. And sometimes I think, why didn't I think of this
yes.
sooner? It made perfect sense, right? And I, like I said, I mean, I've known about the Gertian observation method for a long time, and I'd known about, you know, our approach pedagogically to the different grades, but it never, until just recently,
yep.
it never occurred to me that those could yep. be part of the same. And then when that happened, it was a creation of an opening to a whole new world where I started to think, wow,
yep.
if I could do that with this or
yes.
with that or with
so
the
not
other.
Only your own discovery, not only your own discovery of a subject, but your teaching method then changes and you start to present items in that order of
mm-hmm.
higher complexity, greater involvement with the subject.
Mm-hmm.
Categorizing first and then starting to dig deeper into background and then widening in the time element and then relating yourself to the the subject.
Yes.
That's really lovely.
It's so comforting just to have that as a foundation, too, because then you know exactly what to do.
There you go.
You know, and you're like, okay,
yeah,
I know
give me
what's
a
next.
Subject. Let me have that subject.
Right. Then you want to try it with everything.
Very nice.
Yeah. So.
Well, that's a life's work. I love these little ideas. That's a little idea, right? Mm-hmm. We can talk about it in 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's a lifetime. That's a rich foundation for an entire life.
Yeah. It's amazing how something so small can be so big.
Yeah. You're just saying that as you're looking for a tiny little ant that will hurt you. It really will. Those little fire ants.
There it is.
You got them.
It's in there. But
I have a lot of respect for the fire ants.
I'm trying not to.
Well, thank you, dear. You probably have more to prepare. I saw a chart recently showing the hours involved. If you spend 5 minutes per paper, how many hours of grading? Or if you spend 10 minutes per paper, how many hours of grading in a normal week? Teachers, my God.
It's a lot.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh boy. The simplest ideas are the most profound, aren't they? Thank you, Marie Victoria. That was wonderful. And thank you all for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions, please don't hesitate. ReasoningWithAnOptimist.net has a comments page. You can send me an email there. Thank you very much. Come back next week. Jack Bissett-Mills, goodbye.